This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Finish your year with your dream kitchen with help from Menards. Clearview Cabinetry offers a selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft close doors and drawers and cabinet accessories to match your unique style. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Clearview Cabinets and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of ABA Mom. Today we have a special guest, Mike Carr, who is a parent advocate and has started a nonprofit organization for his son and is known on TikTok as Disability Dad. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's so great to have you. So I just want to go ahead, if you can just share some backstory of J13 and what inspired you to start this nonprofit organization for your son? How did it get started?
So our son's 35 years old. So when he was diagnosed in 1990, the incidence of autism was 1 in 10,000. You know, now the CDC says it's around 1 in 31. So we've seen a huge increase. And the reason that's important to understand our journey is for the first decade or two, no one had seen anybody with autism. I mean, it was a very rare bird. And so trying to get services and trying to find therapists and folks that were familiar with it was a real challenge. And so when he was in his teens, we started thinking about what happens when he falls off the cliff at 22, which we've all thought about, at least if you're a parent of a kiddo that's got severe autism that's getting ready to age out of the school system, you certainly thought about it. And so we went around the country, we looked at programs on the West Coast, on the East Coast, and the Midwest, trying to find a program that maybe we could have for our son. We were willing to move, and we didn't find anything that would accommodate his aggressive behavior, his seizures, his pica behavior. And I know a lot of parents probably have similar situations, right? That you might have a guy like our son who requires high levels of support, or even if your guy or your daughter doesn't require high levels of support, they might have multiple challenges, multiple IDDs, right? So it might be pica, it might be seizures, it might be aggressive behavior, it might be nonverbal, which Michael's mostly nonverbal. And so trying to find a program, even though they might say, oh yeah, we can take them, no problem. And right. Then you find out, well, if they do take them, it's glorified babysitting. There's not a whole lot of ongoing learning and excitement and energy throughout the day, or they get kicked out. And so we ended up moving in 2012, so about 13 years ago. We were in Lago Vista, Texas, which is a suburb outside of Austin. And we contacted the University of Texas, and the special ed, one of the professors there, wanted to take us under her wing. And so she brought in her grad students. She brought in grad students from the speech department. The gal that headed up the speech department was, believe it or not, a BCBA, which we were very lucky about.
That's great.
We brought in nursing. And so for 6 years, the University of Texas helped us build a home program that was really unlike anything else that we could find around the country. I mean, it was a bit unique, and I think they took great pride that there wasn't anything else that they were aware of like this too. And then we split ways because we just didn't have enough money to keep feeding the beast. I don't know if parents know this, but when you start donating money to a D1 college, university, about 50% goes to overhead, which means if you give them $100, you know, $50 goes to your program and $50 goes to the university for other stuff. And we didn't have deep enough pockets, and they had some grants, but not enough. So that became sort of the foundation for John 13, for J13, our nonprofit, because we wanted a program that not only would serve our son, but that was sustainable. And the only way to make it sustainable is if you have a large enough cadre of guys or gals that you're serving, so your staff has a career path, so you have redundancy for backups when somebody calls in sick at the last minute, and lots of other reasons. So that's sort of how it got started.
Yeah, I think that's great. And that's true, too. It seems like a lot of schools will say, yes, I'll take you. And then once they get you, they're like, oh, no, we're not going to take you anymore. So
that's right.
I like that you developed, and it's respite, right? You're doing respite with...
Yeah, the big thing that sort of differentiates us, we haven't found anyone in Central Texas that does respite at all for the population the way we do it. And the key differentiator there for anybody that's thinking about doing this is, if you're trying to prepare your adult child for a residential program down the road when you can no longer take care of them, and that will happen, having them stay in the home for respite services doesn't really prepare them. Because that's the structure and the environment they're used to. What we've done is we actually purchased a house with another couple, and then we have a staff through John 13 that mans the house so that the guys and gals that spend the night there are getting used to spending the night in a totally different environment than the familiar home setting. And the only way that works is to make sure the staff knows them ahead of time. So John 13 has a day program where they come and go out in the community and do fun things and get vocational skills and training and all that kind of stuff. And then once they're comfortable and they've formed some friendships with other folks like them, even though they're nonverbal, they can still communicate and still have a lot of fun. And they really come alive. I mean, that's one of the other problems with having a more isolated respite program just for a single child or even a couple children, is you don't see the social interactions that are so magical when you put these folks together and they start behaving like neurotypical adults, which you maybe normally don't see if they're isolated. So the respite program is outside the house. We had three guys there this last weekend, and then staff, of course, were there at night too. The parents got a break. You know, they could go off for the weekend vacation or go out to date nights or whatever it is. So it does two things that are really important. The first thing I talked about was it gets the guys and the gals ready for extended time away from home and ultimately, you know, residential care in a totally different setting. And then they learn the structure and they learn life skills and everything else in getting ready for that transition that maybe don't learn quite as well at home. The second thing, which I think is even more important, at least the parents tell us, is the parents get a break. You know, some of these parents, you know, haven't been able to go on these May vacations. They haven't been able to enjoy the family gatherings because they got to take care of their kiddo and the staff isn't always around. And so the fact that now they can have an environment that's where they know the staff, they know we're going to take care of their guys and gal, and there's no real worry on their part, that is a game changer for them and for siblings that worry about when mom and dad can't take care of my brother or sister. Now it's on my shoulders. What am I supposed to do? So that's helped a lot.
Yeah. No, that's great. And that's absolutely true where, you know, I've had RBTs go out in the community and, you know, they call out whatever it is, they can't go, then the parents can't go because they don't have that extra support. So I love that you're doing that and giving, you know, parents, I think sometimes feel guilty about taking a break, but it's so important that self-care is so important so you can better care for your child. So I love that you're giving those parents a break. I think it does a couple things. It gives them a different environment, a different setting, introducing to new people that they become familiar with. So I think it's good all the way around. I love that what you're doing for your son and your community. What specific behaviors have you noticed with your son and how do you approach those behaviors?
Well, our son's changed a lot. I mean, we were fortunate enough that they didn't diagnose autism when someone turned one back in 1990, but we took him to the Autism Treatment Center in Richardson, Texas, which was just outside of Dallas, and they had seen guys like him before. And so we got him into training. And I mean, we were doing everything. Kay had two full-time jobs. My wife had two full-time jobs. And I think a lot of moms watching this can probably identify with this. You know, taking care of your son or daughter with severe autism is a absolutely full-time job. And then of course you have the rest of your kids or the rest of the household, or even if you've got a professional career, you've got another full-time job. So it's tough. And so early on, he would do a lot of the classical things. He would bite. He would pull hair. Even when he got a little bit older, we were living in a community. It was a smaller community. And he was walking down the street with a colleague. And he started pulling her hair to the point where she was bent over. And a new police officer drove by and saw it and called in an assault. You know, hey, there's this guy that's assaulting this gal on the side of the road. I need backup. Well, fortunately, we knew the police chief and he heard the call. And he interrupted the new officer. And he said, Describe what you're seeing. And she described Michael. And he said, oh, that's the son of the cars. Go help him. you know, it's not an assault. This guy doesn't understand what's going on. You know, something upset him. And so those types of behaviors will usually surface either, you know, during puberty or, you know, before, afterwards. And if you address them then and you're very proactive, you can mitigate a lot of things that happen later in life. So now Michael has hardly any behavior, whereas some of his colleagues that come in and they're 22, 23, not colleagues, some of his buddies that come in, they're 22 and 23 years old, and they haven't had quite the same journey, might punch a staff member in the face. And we've had this happen. You know, a few weeks ago, we had a staff member at a bowling alley, and just out of the blue, one of the guys punched her in the face and then scratched her. I mean, it was really a severe incident. Normally, that would have resulted in expulsion. You know, there's not a program we know of where if a community member or a citizen, for no apparent reason, punches somebody or scratches somebody in the face, they wouldn't be immediately expelled. Well, they didn't expel them. You know, we were able to take some actions to keep everybody safe, except for the one senior staffer who intervened, unfortunately. We did a post, you know, op afterwards to try to figure out what was the antecedent, what caused the behavior, and figured out it was something we actually did inadvertently, not something that he should have done or, you know, this came out of the blue. So we took responsibility. You know, we took responsibility that, hey, even though he shouldn't have acted that way, we sort of caused that behavior, not maliciously, but we did. And the parent was so relieved and so excited, and the behavior hasn't occurred since then. So with the right structure, you know, you can eliminate the kicking, the punching, the pinching, the hair pulling, all the things that I think parents are used to. But it takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of training of the RTBs and all the other staff that, you know, they know ahead of time how to handle a situation like that before it occurs.
No, that's great. And it's great to have that training ahead of time. And I like that it's not an automatic expulsion, because I know a lot of times in certain schools or day programs where that would absolutely be, you know, an expulsion. And, you know, what I find in my experience, you know, both educationally and just my experience working with, you know, more intensive behaviors is it's usually a lack of communication. Like, I can't communicate to you what's wrong. I can't communicate to you what my wants and needs are. So I'm acting in this very aggressive way, which when you're an adult is a very scary thing. Cause like, just like you mentioned, being a police officer, like a new police officer, right? And there's been incidents where, you know, unfortunately adults with autism have been harmed due to that. And, you know, the police not having that understanding. So that's a very scary thing, but I think what you're doing is great, and also having the staff prepared. Speaking of having a staff prepared, do you do any restraint procedures, or are you mostly doing like proactive procedures?
We haven't had to really go down the restraint path yet. And I think part of it goes back to trying to anticipate a lot of the things that might happen ahead of time, be sensitive to early warning signs, remove the community member from whatever environment is causing the stress or from the other guys or gals that are around them. So, you know, if they're in a restaurant, you know, going outside, if they're in a bowling alley, going outside, and then helping diffuse the situation one-on-one without the noise, the commotion, the lights, all the things that might be triggers too. But Allie, I want to make a comment about on your communication observation, because I absolutely agree. I think one of the things that I have not read nearly enough about, or hasn't been given the emphasis in a lot of the papers and articles that you follow, I'm sure, and that I do too, is it really is anxiety in many cases caused by a lack of understanding on the part of our son or one of his buddies, right? A great example was years ago, we took him to Disney World. And he didn't understand what was about to happen. And we took him on a ride or two that were outside and they weren't as scary. And then we made the mistake of taking him into a ride that was dark. And you go into this ride and the bottom drops out. And so you drop about 20 feet, which is scary enough. And it was the Raiders of the Lost Ark ride. And this boulder starts rolling towards you. And it just scared him out. I mean, he was just crazy scared, as I would be too. And so for the rest of the time there, He didn't want to go back. And so the last day when we were leaving the amusement park, we literally had to carry him onto the bus. He would not get onto the bus that normally would take him to the amusement park from our hotel. So my wife and I carried him on. And when he finally realized he wasn't going back to Disney World or Disneyland, he was so happy, you know, and it was all about anxiety and not being able to convey to him. So whether you use a visual tool like an...
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
iPad with, you know, one, and we have a variety, Picto Select, there are a variety of ways, touch chat, you can communicate with icons or, you know, sign language or verbals if he has a better receptive language than expressive language. You have to establish some way to communicate or at least recognize that if you can't communicate effectively, be very sensitive and be very aware of situations that might create that anxiety and that stress just because of lack of understanding or frustration that he can't express himself in a way that he's understood.
Right. That's true. And I think a lot of parents, you know, they just feel that the vocal communication is important. And it definitely is. That's a way that a lot of us communicate. But any kind of communication is important. So, and I think, too, what you said with anxiety is very interesting because I think even as adults, neurotypical, just that's hard to express to begin with. And then to have all of that heightened senses on top of that and limited vocal communication, that's got to be really scary. Like, not only can I not express to you and tell you what it is that I'm feeling, but I have all these really big feelings right now. So I think that was a great example of that. And you know, I think as adults, like for me, I've gone on rides and I'm like, that wasn't scary. And then my kids are like terrified.
So it's a different
experience for everyone. You know, like my sensory things, like, you know, I hate touching like paper, like when my hands are dry. Some people like hate that feeling. Or like if I have sand and my hands are like, I can't touch it. I'm like, oh, I can't pick that up. I can't pick up the sock. I hate that feeling, you know, and then where some people are just like, no big deal. So I think we all at some level have that. We're all sensory people. And some of us are more high sensory than others. But the thing is I can communicate that. Like, I'm able to say, like, I'm not touching that, or I don't want to go to Disney.
Sensory,
we'll say that.
That observation, Allie, is really important because one of the things that we learned from therapy was Michael was just super sensitive to touch for a while. And so there were fabrics and materials, just like you described the socks, that he either found extremely comforting and soothing, to where we had certain pillows that if he was going crazy, we would just sit him down on the couch and he would just rub the pillow. And it was actually sensory to such an extreme degree that it really calmed him down. On the other side of the fence, we've all seen this where a lot of these guys and gals are super sensitive to loud noises. And so you have to put, you know, headphones over them. Otherwise, because that noise to them is like 10 times as loud as it might be to you or me in terms of how it sets them off.
True.
And they have trouble communicating that other than, you know, they go around with their hands over their ears. So being aware of the fact that, you know, for some guys and gals, the tactile, the senses of feel and touch might just be extremely discomforting or very comforting, or, you know, sound or even taste. You know, there's certain tastes, like Michael loves vinegar. I mean, really likes it, you know, which you would think, oh, that sounds sort of gross or weird. But once you know that, you can understand that, okay, what foods taste does he like or does she like, and which ones, even though you might not find them awful or distasteful, they really react negatively to. So just being aware of that kind of stuff is hugely important.
No, I think that's great too, to just have that awareness. And I think that's, you know, really great too, to just have, like, sometimes, like, even if they can't say it for themselves, we can see it for them. So like, you can't say, ooh, I like this because it has vinegar in it, but we can observe that. So I think that's really important too, is as caregivers to just recognize those things. What advice would you give to parents who are just beginning their journey with a child diagnosed with autism?
Well, the most obvious thing is don't give up hope. I mean, it can be very tough and very stressful, but there is light at the end of the tunnel. What we have seen with our own son and what we've talked a lot of other parents about that have guys and gals that are a little bit younger, you know, in their 20s often or late teens, is they go through periods of transition and behavior, just like, you know, the terrible twos. Well, the terrible twos with someone with severe autism might be the terrible 12s or the terrible eights, or it might be the terrible 15 to 17. So there is a period of time often, I think, when the behavior really is tough and challenging, but with the right, you know, staff, team, crew, structure, help from the school, I think you'll often see improvement over time. The other advice, though, and I think this is hugely important, and unfortunately, schools I was on our school board for a while, and as a school board member, your primary responsibility is fiduciary. That is, you're supposed to make sure the taxpayer money is spent prudently. And that's for all the taxpayers, not just the parents of special needs folks. So here's what that often means is, if a parent knew of all the accommodations that the school district was required to give them, you would certainly take advantage of those, but it also would cost the school district a whole lot of money. So most teachers, most folks that are involved in special ed are coached, I believe, not to volunteer that. They can't misrepresent the facts. So if you're a parent and you come in and you're well informed in terms of what accommodations, communication tools, et cetera, your child is deserving of, and you ask the question, then the school district's responsible to say, yes, we can provide that and we'll cover that cost. But if you don't know, they won't often volunteer it. And the reason is, if too many parents find out that you are a special ed friendly school district or a severely autistic friendly school district, they'll move into the school district. And that we had that happen. And then all of a sudden, more and more of the total budget is now being spent for special ed, which sometimes means cutting other programs for the neurotypical student body. And you can just imagine the rift that causes between parents. The advice I would give parents is, you know, don't give up hope, because things will get better. And number two, be sure you're informed, you know, go through the effort of really understanding, talk to other parents that sort of get it, you know, all the things that you do qualify for, depending upon, you know, how severely autistic your child is, how verbal they are, what other conditions they might have, other needs they might have, and go in well-armed and well-informed if your kiddo is under 22 and they're still in the school system.
Yeah. No, I think that's great advice. And I've seen that too. I've had parents, like, they'll bring an advocate to the IEP meetings. And like you said, it's not that they're not willing, but it's just not all up front. So you kind of have to just dig and figure out what accommodations can be offered to your child. And you're right too, as far as there's only so much funding that they have. So that's a good point too. So I think that's a great advice for parents. What has been some of your biggest challenges and rewards?
I think the biggest challenge that I personally have had as a father, so I'm talking to the dads here, I think the moms are not quite as inclined to do this, is don't set the bar too low. I mean, you know, often parents will have all kinds of aspirations when their kids are young, you know, hey, I'm going to get to go out there and, you know, throw the football, or, you know, kick the soccer ball around and go to the football games, or be the soccer coach on the sidelines, or be the Boy Scout leader. And your son's not going to be able to do that. And so it's at some point, you just sort of give up on a lot of those aspirations. And the bar is basically safety. And so when they age out of the school system, your metric is, hey, if I can just keep them safe, even if that means they're at home by themselves in their bedroom on the computer all day long, with maybe just a little bit of community time because we can afford to have somebody come in and take them out 3 days a week and do something outside the house, that's good enough. That is so low. You would be amazed. One of the things I was just shocked at is we never thought Michael would like to climb. He didn't even understand the concept of holding on. Why would he hold on to a wall? And sure enough, our BCBA and the crew at J13 took him to a climbing gym, and it was laughable. You know, one guy would try to put his foot up on the first climbing notch. It's like 6 inches above the ground, and he would just put his foot back down on the ground. And this went on for like half an hour.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't give up. And he loves food, and he loves certain kinds of food. So they use food as a motivator. So they put the food just like 6 inches above his highest hand reach. So he had to take at least one step up. So the biggest guy would push his rear up. Another person would have him on the belay rope. And a third person would be part of the way up the wall with the candy or the snack.
Yeah.
So over a period of weeks, this actually took months, but the first couple of weeks were the most challenging. He finally would get 4 or 5 feet up, and they'd let go. And he'd be like floating in the air on the rope, looking down, which was sort of a cool sensation. Like, this is sort of fun. Like, everybody's saying, oh, Michael, go, climb, climb, right. Climb. So everybody's cheering at him. He's not in any danger. He's sort of floating, which feels cool. And he's looking down at everybody. And that candy is still above his head. So what happened was, over time, you know, he climbed a full 30-foot wall. Now he's climbing a 60-foot wall that's indoors, all on his own, without any stimulus, without any candy. He learned to love it. And he learned to love, hey, this is challenging and I can do it. And therefore, I'm building my self-confidence. So, and even that by itself, you would think, well, that's a huge breakthrough. But then you see him interacting with other guys, all of whom are nonverbal, and smiling and laughing and giggling and not talking. They're communicating in other ways, and they're having a great time. And you never thought your son or daughter would be so social, because when they're little, they do all the self-stimming and they never pay attention to anybody. And it's like, why would they ever start interacting socially when they were little, they basically ignored all the normal stimuli?
Yeah.
It does happen. And so those are some examples of things that I felt as a dad were amazing. And I regret not having more hope for our son and not having higher expectations for him. You've got to realize the limitations, but at the same time, there are things out there that you can find that they give them joy and you know that they're having fun. You know, it's not something they just don't like to do, but there's that twinkle in their eye or that sparkle or that enthusiasm or that smile or that giggle. I mean, it makes a huge difference.
I think it's just being shown to do it sometimes, right?
Yeah.
So it's just like, I just never learned this skill before. So it's a new experience. So I think that's a great, great example. I have been into a lot of homes where they are older clients. So either like late teens or they're adult clients, and they are like the video games. They're kind of like, and you're right, it's safety. Like they're safe, you know, their school is done, you know, and like you said, like sometimes like somebody comes over. So like myself or like, a, you know, an RBT or something like that. But I'm like, you know, is it enough? Like, I don't know in my area too, that we necessarily have enough for the adults. There's a lot of services for kids, but it's almost just like, you know, you can only have ABA for so long. And then, you know, for adult clients, it's med waiver. And I actually had a client too that I'm like, you know, I told the parent, I said, you know, go ahead, just see, maybe you can apply for med waiver, see what happens. Has it an autism diagnosis? Mom applied and they're like, well, not autistic enough. The state says they're not autistic. And I was like, well, this person can't live on their own, you know, so they definitely need some kind of support. Are they severely autistic? No, but definitely could use extra benefits, like having somebody coming in, helping with some of those life skills with them, things like that. So it's kind of unfortunate. I think that's definitely an area that we need a lot of growth in. And it's definitely an area of need, because I see that so much where the parents are just like, well, they're doing okay. They're doing good. They're in the room. They're on the video games.
It's not cheap, right? To have,
right. It's not.
To have somebody with them when they're, you know, it's after hours. So they're not right. In the day hab, they're not at school. And you're busy, or you've had a hard day at work, or you're trying to get the dinner ready for the kid, the other guys in the family or gals in the family. It's a real tough environment to be in. What's worked well, I think, for some of the other parents that we've worked with where their kiddos aren't maybe severely autistic, so they don't get the same level of financial support, is still providing as much structure as possible. So they might have somebody there that's not quite as well qualified.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like a babysitter, but it's not a babysitter that's just watching them. It's a babysitter that has, you know, 15 things to pick from, you know, and so there's some puzzles. There's some fine motor skills with manipulation of wooden pieces and parts. And then there's some breaks where, you know, you go outside and you walk around the block or you shoot baskets or you do something. And so it's an environment that's both fun for whomever's there and for your son or daughter, and you're not spending quite as much money, or you pair up with another parent or two.
Yeah.
Right. And so now you're spreading the cost for an attendant or a colleague across two guys or three guys, and they have more fun together anyway. Now,
right.
How you pair those up is got to be very strategic, right? You can do a pairing that's, you know, going to last about 10 seconds and then there's a disaster.
Yeah.
But if you're careful and intentional in how you pair up folks, so there's some compatibility there, that's a way to spread the cost. And that's also a way, I think, to provide an environment where the colleagues have more fun. We've seen situations where you'll have two staff and maybe three or four guys go someplace, like go to a park outside or go to a bowling alley. Well, the staff have more fun because they're not stuck at home and they've got right. someone that they can talk to that's neurotypical.
Yep.
The colleagues have more fun because they're a bunch of them, or not the colleagues, the community members, the severely autistic, moderately autistic, even level one autism, they have more fun. One of the things that's really cool is sometimes we'll pair Michael, who's a high support, with a moderate support. Well, the moderate support guy is like his big brother, even though he's younger. And he can get Michael to do things that we as parents cannot get him to do, or that even his colleagues can get him to do. And so that almost can become his job. I mean, you could pay someone that's autistic, but enjoys helping those that require more support, some type of wage. They like it. They're feeling fulfilled. They're having fun. And then now you don't need as an expensive a staff member one-on-one. Now you can have two pairings like that. So two high support, two moderate support, and then just one staff member that's making, you know, an RTB kind of rate. that model works really well, and it is a much more cost-effective way, and it also yields often a better outcome than traditional one-on-one because of the social isolation and all the other problems.
No, those social skills are greatly important. And I think that once they, you know, are out of school, like your social skills are a little bit more limited. So I love that you kind of just get like that community involvement and that you have somebody, I like how you said it, like a big brother.
Right.
And just have, you know, like a model peer to be with. I think that's a great idea. And it definitely is more cost efficient. So that's definitely an excellent idea and a great way to do that. What are your hopes and goals for J13 in the future?
Well, the pot of gold within the rainbow is the full residential program. I mean, that's what That'd every parent wants. I mean, we had a community get together and we were talking about our day program and, you know, people were interested, but they weren't, you know, super engaged. And we talked about a few other things we did. And then one of the dads actually raised the question. He said, how many people here are interested in residential? Everybody's hand went up. Every parent in the audience was interested in residential. Maybe not right away, but it's something that they want to start having a conversation about.
Yeah.
So that's the goal, is that we want a residential program. And what I mean by that is where someone can live, and maybe they live there full time, maybe they live there every other week, but it's basically an environment that's just like home, but it's away from home. And if we do it right, we think they're going to even prefer it over home. And that rubs a lot of moms, especially the wrong way, because they put all that love and effort into the home environment. But every parent recognizes at some point your kids grow up and they want to move away. And that's the same for a profoundly or severely autistic kiddo. You know, they have some of that same innate human desire. And if you can provide an environment where there's more social activity, where they're living with other folks that are neurodivergent, but they still get along well together, and they have a little bit more freedom and independence, and they can dress themselves with minimal support or some support, that usually is a much more positive place for them. And so that's where we're going with it.
Yeah, I think that's a great direction too. And I know, having experience working in a group home, there are parents that are like, you know, I'm not quite sure. They feel there's a lot of guilt in that as well. But honestly, I find it to be a really good experience for the clients, because they get to have like a roommate, basically. You know, they still have the staff to be there to support them. I think the idea of having roommates, because, you know, when you're in your 20s and 30s, like, you know, typically like you move out, you're on your own. So I think the idea of having a residential or a group home, I think it's a fabulous idea. I just know that sometimes the parents, because they've been the caretaker for so long, is so hard for them. Do you have any advice for parents and when they're just having a difficult time, when they're doing like the residential or even feeling guilty about the day program? Like, do you have any advice for them?
Well, it is tough, right? Because often parents have experienced, we certainly have, and all the parents we talk to have, situations where your son or daughter's safety, was really a concern. We had a situation when Michael was little at the school where, you know, he was left unattended, and one of his other classmates was too. And the front door of the school was unlocked, and one of his buddies ran out the front door. And there was a busy street, you know, 20 yards away. Now, fortunately, nothing happened, but those incidences just make you hypersensitive and hyper nervous and hyper concerned. But what happens over time, I think, is a natural awareness grows. It's not perfect. It's not like your child is always going to be aware of those things. But I think Michael now, at least, I don't think he has necessarily the association of danger with cars, but I don't think he would step out in the street. You know, I think he's been pulled back enough. He's been told to stop enough. And with pica behavior, he might pick a leaf and put it in his mouth, and he won't know if that leaf's poisonous or not. But I think he's had enough warnings that he'll do that much slower now and not nearly as often. You also, though, need to be at the right point in your journey. And this is going to sound crazy, I think, to a lot of people that listen to you. I know it sounded crazy to me when I first heard it. But Herb Kelleher, who was the CEO of Southwest Airlines, was the first one that talked about this. And I just thought it was ridiculous until I thought about it. He said the most important person for a Southwest Airlines vision is not the passenger. It's our employees.
Right.
It's the flight attendants. It's the pilots. So think about that. You're the parent and you've got, you know, your kiddo at a group home or residential setting, and you're absolutely convinced the most important person there is my child. It's not the staff. It's not the BCBA. It's not the RTB. Here's why that might not work. If you trust the staff and you really put your faith in them that they are going to love and take care of your kiddos, and the staff feels like, hey, we may not be able to accommodate every kiddo perfectly as if each mom was in that situation, but we absolutely are going to accommodate the group collectively in the best possible way. And your children, your adult children, are going to grow as a result of that. They'll be challenged. And if you were sitting there in that room watching them being challenged in a way that made you a bit uncomfortable, you might just feel like, I got to step in. I got to protect my child.
Right.
Whereas the staff might say, nope. Let's see what happens. Their safety is not at risk, right? So I don't think this ever gets into a situation where you put the staff's safety or the staff's convenience ahead of your child. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about an engaged staff that's well-trained, a team. They will intentionally let some things go, let some things happen that you as a parent would probably not let happen, because they want your child, your adult child, to experience it and to figure it out for themselves. And by putting the staff first, you have to be able to trust the staff. They have to be well trained to do this. And then giving them the rope and the opportunity to help your child grow in those ways is tough, hard to do. But you'll see some amazing things happen if you let that in the right environment.
Yeah, I think that that's great too. And then just kind of let them lead and just see what they can kind of do. Like, honestly, like, it's a way that I kind of teach independence too for some of my kids and adults, is like, okay, let's just see what you're going to do. Let's kind of see what you're capable of. And of course, like, never putting them like in a safety risk situation. But I think that that's really important too. And I think it's important for parents, because I think our job is to protect our kids. And if it's like, but they might do this, right? They might go do this. They might do this. So there's always this fear of safety, but then just recognizing, like, is this an unsafe environment, or do I just need to step back? So I think what you're doing is great, because sometimes parents don't realize it when we need to step back. So I think that that's great. I think that's wonderful.
I think patience is part of that.
Patience too.
Yeah. I don't think, and here again, I may be a bit sexist here, but I just don't think most dads have the patience that moms do. I just don't. And I'll just go crazy. I mean, I can't, you know, I'll sit there and watch Michael try to put a sock on. And, you know, after about 2 minutes and he can't get it on right, I'm just saying, just let me do it. Right. And that's the worst thing. You can't step in. You just have to sort. And he'll get it wrong a bunch of times. And so the shoe will be on the wrong way, or have mismatched socks, or this and that. But finally, if you let them do it with minimal intervention, yeah, at first you got to help some. And they finally get it. And oh, yeah, the sock's on. So when my shoe goes on, it feels comfortable and I don't have to go around and take my shoe off 15 times. They will learn. You just have to be almost efficient. I have not gotten anywhere close to that yet. But I think the staff, you know, you're looking for folks that are willing to sort of sit back and let them learn on their own. It may take 5 times as long or 10 times as long. But once they've learned it, you know, then they've got it. And then they're a little bit more independent. Then they've got more of the life skills that they really need to have to go out into that residential setting and thrive and enjoy life without mom and dad always hovering around them.
Yeah, no, I think that is great. And I will tell you, patience is hard, and it's not always something that comes naturally. I think it's something that you teach yourself over time, because I know one thing for me is because even my kids, like, they're like, mom's just ignoring us. Like, you know, I just do that plan ignoring for all of this like junk behavior, because it's so ingrained in me to do that. It's just like second nature. But I didn't always do that. I used to react to everything. So I think it's something that can be taught, patience, but it's not easy. But I think that's great what you're doing, and you're hiring the staff that are willing to try and work towards being patient and kind of sitting back and waiting, especially if, you know, you're going on an outing. It's like, okay, we're just waiting on this one to put their shoes on to go out to the park, and everyone's waiting. But then you're teaching waiting to anybody else that's there, right? So it's like, oh, we got to wait for our friend to put his shoes on. But then you're also teaching him, like, oh, I am capable of putting my shoes on, even if it's just partially doing it. Like, you are capable of some of this skill. So I think it's great what you're doing. It's something that I definitely use a lot.
that's important, right? I mean,
right.
And I think not reacting. I know you as a BCBA have probably had this conversation with every one of your parents. But this is also, I think, very counterintuitive. Our son doesn't care what causes the reaction. If he gets a reaction because he's misbehaving, Right. That's just as good. He gets the same level of juice and joy out of that as when he does something right. And so when he takes his puzzle and turns it upside down, looking at you, and the puzzle piece is going flying all over the floor right before he's supposed to go to bed. And the only reason he does that is to get that reaction. And as soon as he sees you react, he smiles. It makes no difference if you yell at him.
Yep.
Actually, if you yell at him, he even likes that more because now you're paying even more attention to him.
Right.
Whereas if you're just stone-faced and you don't react at all, even though that's something we know he's not supposed to do, then he gets tired of doing it. And so trying to learn the discipline of only react for the positive behaviors, because that's what the reinforcer is, and not react the way he wants you to for the negative behaviors, because that's also a reinforcer of those negative behaviors, is really a hard skill to learn as a parent. But I think if you learn it, it really makes a difference.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great skill. And it's, you know, negative attention is still attention. And some kids or adults, they love that.
That's right.
So it's still a response. Yep. So, yeah. And I love that you said that too, because that's absolutely right. Just reinforcing those behaviors that you want to see more of. So all of that positive reinforcement for behaviors you want to see more of too, because I've seen the other side of that where sometimes parents are reacting, you know, and it's not intentional, you know, they're just like, they want their kids to just follow directions. And so they're responding to a lot of negative behaviors or giving a lot of negative attention and then not responding when they do the correct thing. They're like,
right.
Well, they were supposed to do it.
That's right.
So, yeah. So I think that's very important too. And sometimes I think parents, they just don't recognize a lot of times that they're doing it. They just are like, oh, I just want them to follow directions. Like, I want them to listen to me because I'm the parent.
You're right. I agree.
So what are some, and I know you shared a little bit about this, what we were just talking about with providing that reinforcement, but what are some practical strategies that you've learned through your experiences that other parents can implement at home?
Well, our son likes attention, I think, as you already just said. And so overdoing the positive accolades, the cheering, the high fives, the smiles, the hugs, whatever your child views as a positive reinforcement, to an extreme degree, really helps, right? So it's curtailing any kind of reaction or attention for negative behavior. And it's really juicing up the things when they do something right and being consistent. Mm-hmm. I think consistency is one of the hardest things for parents to do compared to like the school situation. And I've talked to a lot of therapists, RTBs, BCBAs, and you probably have too. If parents would just do what we do when we're there providing therapy, it would just make everyone's life so much easier and you would see so much improvement.
Right.
But when they only have 2 hours of therapy a day, or they're only in clinic for 4 hours a day, or when they're only in school for 6 hours a day, and then they come home and none of the supports are in place, the environment's totally different. Well, you lose all that. You lose all that learning and all that progress. And a good example of this is vacations, right?
Right.
I've talked to a lot of teachers that dread the first day coming back after a Christmas vacation because
so
everyone's regressed. You know, now they've got to spend the first week or two or three just getting behavior and everyone back to where they were before they left because no one paid any attention to their behavior over Christmas holidays or they reinforced all the negative stuff. So that consistency as much as possible, you know, after hours when the therapists aren't around, I just think is hugely important.
Yeah. I completely agree with that, and I've seen that as well. And I think, too, different environments. So the school environment is definitely like there's different demands on you. So there's schoolwork, like there's a schedule. You come home, maybe you're eating dinner, it's playing video games, things like that. So there's a lot less demands. And I think, you know, even if you're on vacation, it could be kind of a laxed schedule. But I think just having some kind of a schedule is important. Maybe like picking out something that is like a less preferred activity. So it doesn't have to be totally like, I hate this.
Right.
And maybe you try something you don't really like. And I think, too, just like your son learning to climb up on the wall, you know, it's like, well, I don't even know what the point of this is. Right. So it's not like a non-preferred activity. It's just something he doesn't have experience in. And that's a lot of ways like where you can grow and gain new skills. So now it's like, oh, now I can climb up a wall. Like I can great. But, you know, where I couldn't do that before. I'm definitely on the same page with you as far as having out parents. I've heard that from teachers. It's like, okay, the breaks, they're coming back. So, you know, all of those strategies we taught them, they probably didn't use them over the break. So we'll come back and we'll try again.
Well, the real world is, and I think you're, you know, you're talking about how this, the environment's not going to be a structured home. And
it's
I absolutely
not,
agree with that.
It's going to be different.
The real world is, in my opinion, it has to be fun. It has to be fun for the parents too, or the siblings too.
Right.
You cannot expect a parent. And we had a lot of discussions with the folks at University of Texas because they were very forgiving of us. And they understood that if you can come up with things that are enjoyable for everyone, and again, it's not maybe your autistic child's favorite activity, but they still get some juice out of it. They still get some enjoyment out of it. And their siblings do too. That way, everyone is sort of looking forward to it. Versus, I think it's pretty unrealistic, unless you're just an exceptional parent, to expect the same environment that the BCBA or the RTB is taking your son or daughter through 2 hours or 4 hours a day in therapy or at the clinic. That's not sustainable outside the home. That's a very intense. So trying to find that sweet spot, that balance between something that's so unstructured, they get bored, and that's when the behavior starts.
Right.
Versus something that's somewhat structured and fun and enjoyable, but not quite as structured and challenging as in the in-clinic experience, that's usually the spot, I think, to strive for.
No, I think that's a great point, too. And I mean, I wouldn't want the parent to be in a situation where it's like, where they dread it.
Right.
After I leave, it's like, oh, she wants me to do all this stuff and I have all this homework and it's another thing to do on my to-do list. So I think that's a great point too, is still make it fun. Like you can still do, you know, I love NET goals, like the natural environment teaching, because you can do them anywhere. So like reading, turn taking, like all of those things, like you can do, you know, functional communication. So, you know, if they have like a picture board or an iPad, like you can do that outside of session. Like you can just keep communicating. It's like, oh, what is it that you want? Okay, like show me. So just those simple things to keep up with. I think that's really important. But I really like what you said about keeping it fun.
Let me mention one thing that's helped us. And I am a strong advocate of this to an extreme degree. So I'm not suggesting this for everyone. I believe that nutrition and physical exercise are two of the greatest gifts for behavior control. Yeah. So if you think your kiddo is going to be just as well behaved if they just had that huge bag of Cheetos or the three candy bars and they've got this sugar high, I mean, just like anybody, you know, it's going to juice them up and they're going to have a hard time controlling themselves and everything else.
Right.
And just like if you go out on a walk, like I love to go outside and walk and our son likes to do that too, or go outside and shoot basketball or swim, you know, so there's some exercise involved, right? And so some of that built up tension and anxiety and stress is relieved through whatever physical activity is enjoyable for the parent and the child, then everyone's happier. I mean, last night, our son, you know, after dinner, his colleague took him out on a walk, what she thought was going to be a walk. He just took off. He started running. And she said it was going to be a mile walk and ended up being a 0.1 mile walk and a 0.9 mile jog. But he was so happy and calm when he came back because he had that pent up energy. He hadn't been able to release it all day long. And he finally got to release it. And so he went to bed without the hassle and all the other stuff. So I don't think you can forget some things that are relatively easy and maybe enjoyable for everyone. And that might be some type of exercise or physical activity, and certainly watching nutrition. I just think that makes eminent sense.
Right. And there's a lot of research, you know, that says like, you know, sugar, caffeine, those all like affect our body in the way that we function. Like that definitely affects neurotypical and neurodivergent individuals alike. So it definitely has an impact versus, you know, having like a healthy balanced meal. But I like what you're saying about the pent-up energy too and being able to release that. So whether or not you eat nutritious food or not, like if you still have that pent-up energy, sometimes it's good to have that release too. So lastly, how do you take care of yourself?
Well, my wife's the saint in our household. And I think this is true for many moms. I'm not saying there aren't some dads out there that aren't amazing. I mean, I've met some of them, but in general, the excuse that I've always had was, well, you know, I'm out there working hard, bringing in the bucks, although my wife worked too, and she's bringing in bucks as well. And I'll go out and I'll do the easy, fun things, like I'll go out for the walks or shoot the baskets, you know, or maybe make some of the meals. But if you really want me to sit down there at the table and do the work that requires, you know, incredible patience, that's a real challenge. And so I think you just have to recognize what you're good at and what drives you crazy. And you need, I don't agree with the philosophy, and I'm not sure a lot of people advocate this. Well, lean into your weaknesses. You know, like if you're an impatient person naturally, well, just work at being more patient. Well, you can do that to a certain degree,
right.
But that's like uphill. I mean, that's really hard to maintain and sustain. Whereas, hey, I know I'm not as patient. I don't do the table work as well, but I love the physical activity and I love going outside and I like the games. So let me do the things that I'm better at, especially if your spouse has a different superpower and she is much more comfortable with the table work or the dressing skills or whatever it is, the nighttime routine, and try to figure out that balance where you're taking care of yourself by doing things with your son that you enjoy doing, so it's not that big a challenge, and you also feel like you're contributing, and you're also helping your spouse do things that she isn't as inclined to do because she doesn't want to necessarily go out and exercise as much as you, but she certainly wants to help with the indoor stuff. So if you do it right, I think it's both taking care of yourself and taking care of your spouse, which of course then benefits everybody because now your marriage isn't going to fall apart, and and recognizing that you need some alone time. So, you know, with respite care, you know, we took a week off and went to Italy this summer. Well, that was fantastic. You know, you have to be in a position where you've got the staff and the team that you can trust to do that. But even taking a night off and not forgetting that, you know, hey, we can go out for dinner. Maybe it's an early dinner. Maybe we have to be back at 8:30 or 9 to relieve the staff. But at least we got a night out by ourselves to talk to one another and catch up and do the old things we used to do when we were dating before we had all the kids.
Yeah. No, I think that's important too. You know, I think any marriage counselor will tell you, you know, with your kids, like you've got to take time for your marriage. So that's really important too. So not only are you taking care of yourself, but taking care of your marriage as well. So I think that's very important. And honestly, you know, statistics for divorce when kids are diagnosed with autism is really high. So it's more likely to get divorced when you have a child with that diagnosis. Unfortunately, that's the statistics on that. So I think it's really important what you're doing and taking time for your wife. She sounds amazing.
She is. I don't think anyone else could have lived with me and our son except for her.
No, that's great. Perfect. Well, Mike, I appreciate your time so much today. Yeah. And if there's anything else you want to share with our listeners before we sign off.
I'm not trying to advocate for Christianity or Catholicism, but I absolutely believe that if you are a Christian or you are Jewish or you believe in God of some form, that faith is just hugely important. And it's a solace and it's a place you can go in the darkest times that can really make a difference. So I don't want to offend anyone that's watching or listening to this, but our nonprofit was based upon, you know, the John 13 verse in the Bible where Jesus is washing the feet of the disciples. No one is, you know, too high and mighty not to get down on their hands and knees and try to take care of your son or your daughter and help out. For those of you that are inclined that way, that has been a huge help for us. And I would certainly recommend you continuing to think about and make use of that.
I think that's beautiful. And having that servant's heart is very important. So
absolutely.
Thank you so much for sharing that and about how faith has helped you too.
Yeah, we've got a guy on our advisory board who's Jewish, but every morning he reads the Torah and then he reads a chapter from the New Testament in the Christian Bible. And that's sort of, I think, the mindset that, look, we all believe in God. We all believe in spirituality. You know, there are certainly differences between Christianity and Judaism and other faiths, but there's a certain base foundation there in terms of serving others, taking care of others, helping others. That's sort of that common thread. That's what's hugely important.
Absolutely. Oh, and I love that. That's so cool that he reads the New Testament. And
yeah, I have not been able to do that. I'm barely able to get through the Christian stuff. I can't imagine picking up the Torah and starting to read that, but it might be something in the future I try to do.
No, that's amazing. I think that's awesome. So, all right. Well, Mike, it was such a pleasure having you today.
The nonprofit website is john13.org or j13.org. So if you want to learn more about what we're doing with our nonprofit and respite care and our day program, go there. The autismlabs.com website is where we try to have videos that are educational, where you can learn about our journey and things that we as parents of a 35-year-old severely autistic son have had to wrestle with. So either place is a great place to go, and you'll find hopefully some things of value and use.
Thank you again, Mike. It was a pleasure having you today.
You bet. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.